Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes, and this is the Zero Point Show through BBS Radio. It is April 16th, 2011. And co-host is on with me, Jim Moffitt from Toronto, Ontario. Hi, Jim.
Oh, hi, Chris.
How are you? You got a cold, rainy day there?
Oh, it's unbelievably cold and unbelievably miserable, actually. It feels like the beginning of winter rather than the beginning of spring, you know.
Yeah, we've really had a chill the last couple of days. Very cold here again, too.
Yeah.
Okay, so, well, we're going to have two parts to our show today. In the first half, Jim and I are going to pick up again and continue on with our discussions of Beelzebub's tales to his grandson, which is Beelzebub's classic work of esoteric language. In the second half, we have a prominent Canadian activist, Dee Nicholson, who will be joining us to discuss Canadian election and just generally the news of what's going on in the world. Okay, so the first hour, Jim and I will pick up on Beelzebub. But before I do that, I'm looking around for it here. I've misplaced it. I have I picked out a new I picked a used books up at used bookstore, and it was a Sri Chinmoy book. And somewhere, oh, here it is. Okay, and I just found this book, and I opened up, and it was interesting because the first section was entitled Consciousness. And that's a major issue that Jim and I explore through this radio series, is looking at the origins and nature of human consciousness. And people just don't realize what a profound mystery this is, like how consciousness, and when I say consciousness, what I mean in a general way by that term is that each of us has an inner awareness of being within us. Like each of us has that kind of inner being awareness. And that's in a general way but what I mean by the term consciousness. And that inner awareness each of us has, you can never observe that in somebody else. Okay, we have to admit that. Like, you can see a person's outward facial signs or how they behave, but you can never directly observe anybody else's consciousness. Okay, and you can study animals all you want, and you can observe animals your whole life, but you'll never observe their consciousness. Instead, and this is a very profound point made by Gurdjieff, and it's kind of completely ignored in ways of modern psychology. You can only study consciousness in yourself. That's the only place you can be aware of what consciousness is. You have to study it in yourself. And that's been the method ignored in the Western mainstream of science, but that's the focus in the Gurdjieff teaching. So, anyway, I came across this book by Sri Chinmoy, who I would consider a genuine initiate, and he was a very, very unusual and talented man, Sri Chinmoy, and his teachings are generally in the yogic Vedic tradition of India, and he was an amazing flute player. And have you ever seen the picture, Jim, of him lifting like a bus, those kind of amazing physical feats he was supposed to perform?
Yeah, I know he did like a billion push-ups or something. He set some sort of world record for doing push-ups too.
I didn't know that.
Oh yeah, yeah. He had this whole thing. I could never kind of figure out what's that about, that he was doing all these push-ups that's rings a bell. I know that there was something about him doing all these feats of amazing physical strength. I don't remember it offhand about the bus, but it sort of, you know, I probably saw it, because what really struck me was he's doing all these push-ups, and I thought, why is he doing it?
Yeah, it was like
Like thousands and thousands and thousands of push-ups, eh? Like, it was very peculiar.
Yeah, in this picture I'd seen them, they had a way by which he could be partly under a bus, and he was supposed to have actually lifted one side of it up.
Wow.
Not, like, off the ground, but just actually, yeah, a very unusual man. Anyway, Sri Chinmoy died a few years ago, and he founded, it used to be called the 3HO Foundation. I don't know if they're still around or not, and the 3Hs stand for happy, healthy, and holy. Anyway, at the beginning of his book, it reads consciousness. And I often look how other people use the term, and in this case, he uses it in a way exactly compatible with the things that Jim and I talk about. So anyway, the first part, it says consciousness dash light, he says. And then he says consciousness is the spark of life which connects each one of us with the universal life. Now, there is very interesting. See, the idea of the spark of life. So there he's talking about consciousness as though it originates from a point source or a spark. Okay, then this is Sri Chinmoy. It is the thread that puts us in tune with the universe. If you want to fly into the transcendental, you need the thread of consciousness. Consciousness is a spark that lets us enter into the light. It is our consciousness which connects us with God. It is the link between God and man, between heaven and earth. And that's a major point Jim and I are always making in this program, is the issue of consciousness is central to this question of the existence or non-existence of the human spirit and soul. Because in the modern view in psychology and science, the belief is that the brain in the head produces human consciousness somehow through neurological processes. But no one's ever able to explain how or where this is done. But in the mystical teachings, consciousness is evidence of the spirit soul or the divine element or divine spark within the human being. So this is how Jim and I discuss consciousness. It's evidence of the spiritual soul, and we equate consciousness with light. It's like consciousness is the light of the self. And in mystical teachings, the self within the heart is described as inherently self-illuminating like the sun. Okay, so that's first part here of Sri Chinmoy. He twice refers to consciousness as a spark. Okay, then it goes on a little bit. He says, in the physical world, the mother tells the child who his father is. In the spiritual world, our aspiration tells us who God is. Who is God? God is an infinite consciousness. He is also the self-illuminating light. There is no human being who does not have within him this infinite consciousness and this self-illuminating light. So that's just the basis of what I wanted to read out of Sri Chinmoy. But we see the similar to the themes of, that Jim and I discuss is consciousness as light, consciousness as originating from a divine or spiritual spark or spiritual self. In this passage, Sri Chinmoy doesn't talk about the self as connected to the heart, but I know he teaches that elsewhere. Yeah, that was a nice quote, eh, Jim?
What's the book that's from?
That's called The Beyond Within.
Oh, okay. 'Cause I know there's one quote that I think it's about the spiritual spark that's in your book. I think it's in the Heart Doctrine that you quote that I always like from Sri Chinmoy, where he's talking with very good explanation of kind of basic Vedic principles, as you say. I can't recall the quote, but I like it. It's one of my favorites in terms of explaining this idea about the spiritual spark and the light and the self-illuminating nature of that spark. By the way, you know that the Shakti song, I am dancing at the feet of my guru, all is bliss, John McLaughlin and Shakti?
Oh, yeah.
You know who that is, eh? That's Sri Chinmoy. Sri Chinmoy was John McLaughlin's guru.
Oh, he was?
Yeah.
And I didn't know that.
And Carlos Santana's, too.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, how interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was just thinking that there was fascinating music that was coming out kind of in the 60s and 70s with John McLaughlin, the Maharishnu
Orchestra. Yeah, I'm on the first Mahavishnu Orchestra album, My Goals Beyond. There's a picture of Sri Chinmoy on the front cover.
Oh, really? Oh,
he has like a little devotional, and there's with flowers and everything, and there's this picture of Sri Chinmoy, and there's actually a poem, I believe, on the back cover of that album to Sri Chinmoy from John McLaughlin. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, because he was a musician himself too.
Yes, Sri Chinmoy. He was an amazing flute player.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember when he came to Toronto, they rented the International Center and had 30,000 people and gave out free tickets all around Toronto.
Yeah,
they're quite a remarkable man.
Were those guys that remember when we were living in Maple and we had that first group in the summer of 1984 came up and played on that stage, played the free concert on the stage that we had on the property?
Yeah, Shakti. That was the name of that group.
Weren't they like Sri Chinmoy guys?
I think they were. Yes, I think they were.
70s, because that seems to me they was when he had come to Toronto, and they were somehow. I thought they were followers of his, but I could be wrong. But that's a very that's a perfect description. I mean, I was thinking earlier, it's so incredibly different from like the modern psychological and philosophical positions. Like you have somebody like Daniel Dennett, who's they call it eliminative materialism, like eliminate only the adjective, eliminative materialism is their position on consciousness, which is like there is no consciousness, we just have this flow of thoughts and feelings, and even that's illusory because they're just basically discrete events, you know, and that there is no such thing as consciousness. But in a way, like it, consciousness, as you say, it all comes from that statement from Gurdjieff, is that you can't know it in others. And even the idea that you can know it in yourself is that it's difficult to know it in yourself because studying yourself is not, like there's a speech that Gurdjieff gives in Search of the Miraculous where he says, to observe yourself is not nearly as simple as you might think, and that it requires a certain structure of categories to understand what's going on, and it requires certain practices to be brought to your attention that you have to do to really study your own consciousness and to begin to understand that it's much more variable than you would assume, and that in Gurdjieff's terms, that typically you're not properly conscious, that you're actually quite unconscious, and so it's a much more sophisticated methodology is involved to study consciousness in yourself than I think anybody's really recognized in Western science or psychology, and that in part accounts, I think, for why people have not properly pursued it and have just sort of assumed that it's ultimately just a subjective process. But I would argue it's exactly the opposite, is that it's really the most objective way of studying consciousness.
Yeah. Yeah, and it is, as we say, it is the only way. You can't observe it or study it in someone else.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, it's a self-evident truth in a way. Yeah. Yeah, and as you say, yeah, Gurdjieff isn't saying it's easy to study in yourself. In fact, he's saying it's very difficult because he's saying we're not properly conscious. So we have to study it in ourselves, but he doesn't mean just for an afternoon or a couple minutes. He means as a process through your life, as you make efforts to wake up and become more conscious, or what he would call properly conscious. Because he would say most people are not properly conscious. And Gurdjieff would say that the state of consciousness which should be established in people is what he would call the state of self-consciousness. But he says that people ordinarily think they already know what self-consciousness is. And he says that's the principal mistake. And so if you think you already have self-consciousness, then it's not going to be something to which you would strive. And he says that's one of our psychological illusions. Uspensky talks in that term as well. So for Gurdjieff, it's not just that we can study it in ourselves simply, but it's a process that takes over time, and it brings about a change in your inner conscious experience and state. And so it's a long-term process. I mean, I feel it's like a lifetime process, really, Jim, to understand the nature of consciousness, the nature of self and soul and such. And I can't imagine having lived life without this adventure that we've had in trying to explore these things, because it's not just an intellectual adventure. It's an adventure you undertake in terms of trying through your life to be aware of yourself and wake up and be more fully conscious. And it kind of changes one's life in doing it. And it involves you in this kind of process of discovery. It's amazing. I can't imagine having lived life without have learning the process of self-remembering that Gurdjieff teaches, which is kind of the principal means of studying consciousness. And in that method of self-remembering, what we do as we go about our lives, when we remember to be aware of ourselves, we take moments to kind of enhance our wakefulness in the present moment, being aware of what's going on within us and around us. So we try to have moments of this enhanced awareness through our days at different points where we remember to do it. And it's over time that gradually helps to develop something in you. Go ahead, Jim.
No, I was just going to say, as you say, I mean, it's interesting because it is a lifetime process of discovery and awakening in the sense, and at the same time, it's as you say, those moments like when you, in the Gurdjieff teaching, it's called self-remembering, where you try to enhance your awareness of yourself, like that most basic exercise, even trying to do that, like, see, that's something that's not recognized as being of any significance in modern psychology. In modern psychology, when people talk about consciousness, they talk about the waking state and they talk about sleep, and there's just these two states. And nobody really attributes any significance to the idea that you can increase or enhance your awareness of yourself or of your being and of your presence in any moment, and have completely missed the significance of this. Like, I would say, like what Gurdjieff describes when he says, try to remember yourself to be present and to maintain. Well, in one way, the idea of self-remembering is to maintain the sense, I am here. And it's very difficult to do, even that most simple exercise. But what that reveals, like, I think that's the most profound psychological experiment I've ever been taught, is that you can't maintain that. Like, you can do it, and you can have a sense of how things are different, and you can experience yourself in a very different way, but you can't maintain it because you fall asleep, and you go back into the normal waking state of consciousness, which consists of essentially what Gurdjieff terms a waking sleep, where you're very you're aware of yourself in only the most kind of dull and fragmented ways. But it is possible through repeated attempts to try to awaken, to increase and enhance those moments of self-awareness, and to change the quality of your consciousness. And only you can really understand this by doing this yourself, as it brings us back to the point, like, you can only know consciousness in yourself. And the exercise of doing that, I think, is just like so profoundly significant, and awakens you to so many hidden variables in terms of consciousness and hidden truths about consciousness, that you realize that the whole Western academic, psychological, and philosophical approach is just, it's blither. I think it's mainly an intellectual abstraction and observations which are clearly not grounded in reality. And I think that most Western psychology has completely missed the boat in terms of discussing consciousness. Like, they've tried to study it where it doesn't exist. They've tried to define it in ways that it can't be defined. They've tried to dismiss it when it should never be dismissed. And they've completely taken it out of the context, the greater context of higher states of consciousness and spiritual states of consciousness, and missed the significance of that. So the whole I'd say the whole Western academic psychological approach, while it can teach us certain things about consciousness, is basically grounded in the wrong methods and basically grounded in the wrong ideas. And I think that's what esotericism, all esoteric teachings deal with much more effectively and meaningfully than any Western teaching.
Yeah, and particularly Western methodologies, because Western academics approach it with an academic theoretical, from an academic or theoretical position, they use their mind to investigate consciousness. And what's interesting is the very fact of your using your mind to investigate consciousness or to think about it, and then they end up thinking that the consciousness consists in the minding and thinking. So this is partly, see, how they identify consciousness so much with the head, because they approach its understanding with the mind, centered in the head. Whereas if you go into self, if you try to experience consciousness immediately with yourself, I think it becomes very immediately apparent that it doesn't seem to be the case that you only are conscious up in your head. It seems to be the case that you can have consciousness through your body. And one of the first things you do in self-remembering, which Gurdjieff emphasizes as a way of studying consciousness, the first thing you do, he calls it self-sensing. You try to sense yourself inwardly from the tip of your toes to the top of your head, like all through your body, to ground your awareness in your physicality. And I think if we do this, like my experience now is like I can lay down and it feels to me as though I can be conscious all through myself simultaneously at one time. And in what Jim and I are sharing is we're connecting consciousness to blood flow, which is a very different conception of what consciousness is. We're connecting it to blood flow. And somehow there's this light of consciousness associated with the blood, and it serves to illuminate or enables you to be aware of different objects of experience. So if you use a part of your mind, say I do some arithmetic questions, well then blood will flow in a certain way to part of my parietal lobe, because that's a part of the brain used for doing arithmetic skills. But that doesn't mean that that part of the brain is producing the consciousness. See, modern scientists, they study how different parts of the brain are required for different cognitive tasks. And the way they see what part of the brain is required is that they monitor the blood flow. So if you use a particular part of your parietal lobe for an arithmetic question, there's increased blood flow to the parietal lobe. Now, the scientists don't think that the consciousness of that task has anything to do with the blood flow. They don't even mention that as pertinent to the issue of consciousness. They think it's only that neurological processes which somehow are producing that consciousness. So this perspective also offers a interesting alternative interpretation of different data of science, which can be interpreted in a way to in supportive of what I would say is that consciousness is distributed through the body and is connected to blood flow. And I think another good example of that is where a person eats a big meal, and it may feel afterwards, you may feel stuffed and kind of bloated in your stomach. And in a way, it feels like your consciousness is in your stomach. And I would actually say, yes, you can be conscious in your stomach. You can be conscious of a full stomach in your gut. So it's like consciousness can be all through our body. If I put my attention into my feet, I can heat my feet up about 10 degrees in under 15 seconds just by putting my attention into my feet. And what happens, the way your temperature goes up, is the blood flows. You put your attention in your feet, your blood flow to your feet, and then your feet get warmer. So there's nothing like mysterious about it, like it's a direct kind of mechanism. So this is partly what Jim and I explore in terms of trying to understand consciousness, how it's not really produced by neurological activities, but rather that it's connected to the blood. And it's even more complex than that, because we don't simply mean physical blood as we ordinarily think of it, even though that's part of the equation. But Gurdjieff would also talk about the blood of the higher being bodies. Like, Gurdjieff has a special name called Handbladzorn, which is what he uses to refer to the blood of the astral body. And he has another term, even more difficult, that he uses for the blood of the mental body. So these are like energies, radiative energies, that are connected to the blood flow in the physical and subtle bodies. And these, for Gurdjieff, are the basis for conscious experience. So it's a very interesting alternate perspective, but I still don't know anyone in the mainstream of science who really considers the kind of perspectives we share on this issue. And then further, Jim and I have this, we discuss the concept of the zero-point origin of consciousness, meaning the idea that it does originate from, like, what Sri Ching Moy calls a spark, that there is a God spark or a divine element within the human being. In Kabbalah, sometimes they're called sparks of holiness. And the Sufis talk of the same thing. One Sufi calls it the mystery of mysteries, he says, is the way that we have this divine spark within us. So what Jim and I do, in a way, we take a section like that by Sri Ching Moy, where he describes consciousness as the spark of this kind of infinite God-light consciousness, and we consider that seriously from a scientific viewpoint. Because a lot of people read things like this and think, oh, that's nice, and it's metaphorical, and but they think it's metaphor. Okay, but Jim and I are actually saying, no, we don't. We want to take these notions seriously and try to consider that as a scientific perspective. And that's what we've done. I mean, that's what I do in the Heart Doctrine book. And that's what we share through these shows, is this kind of alternative view of what consciousness is. And consciousness, we relate to light, we connect it to the heart, we connect it to the blood flow, we compare it to the background of experience. It's like consciousness is like this form of no-thingness, which then allows you to be aware of all the different things. Just like if you have a light in your room, and the light lights the room and lets you be aware of all the different objects in the room, the dresser and the walls and the whatever's in your room. Similarly, there's this consciousness within us, and then that allows us to be aware of all these different things, aware of sensation in your foot, or aware of what's going on in your mind, or aware of what you're feeling in your heart. So the objects of consciousness are something separate from the consciousness as well. And that is something that we see in Western psychology. William James was very influential. And he says, thoughts, feelings, sensations, no, by states of consciousness, he says, I mean thoughts, feelings, sensations, and all the rest. So William James equated consciousness with the psychological functions, whereas for Gurdjieff, consciousness is different from thinking or feeling or sensations. It's the light which illuminates these processes within ourselves. And each human being has this inner light source, even though we may largely live in darkness. Because this is another idea of esoteric teachings, eh, Jim, that we live in darkness and we have to, like, find the light or know the light within ourselves.
Yeah.
And we find that throughout all the esoteric teachings is this basic theme that humankind is asleep. They do not know themselves.
Yeah, it's very interesting. There's so many different angles, and you've actually said a lot in just the last few minutes of different parts of it. Like, one part, like, that you mentioned is within the Gurdjieff teaching, is this idea that he says that we can consider human beings to be three-brained beings with an intellectual center, with an emotional center, and an organic or moving instinctual center. And these are three distinct centers of intelligence within a human being that each has its own way of knowing and its own speed of operation, its own type of memory. And that each of these brains operates quite independently within us, but they also interact and they influence one another. And that within us we have a center of gravity for each of these brains, and that we, in our consciousness, we can be centered in different ways, as you say, like when you're doing an activity such as mathematical operation or talking on the radio, you're centered more in your head because you're using more of an intellectual process that's what your activity involves. But then if you go out and you run for several kilometers or several miles, and you're centered more in your physical body and your attuned to your breathing and the smooth operation of your muscles and trying to be aware of yourself physically, so you're less centered in your head. And as you said, blood flow is a critical aspect of this. It's like one of the most striking examples of blood flow is that when you're sexually aroused, your blood flows to your sexual organs, and you're not centered in your head. You're centered in your sexual organs, and so. When within the normal flow of consciousness, like what William James would term the stream of consciousness, you can be, your consciousness is continually changing, so you can be centered in various, like if you become emotionally upset or emotionally elated or have some sort of extreme emotional reaction, often those reactions, the center of gravity of those reactions, it isn't in your brain, it isn't in your limbic system, which is, according to conventional thinking today, is responsible for emotional reactions. You experience emotions in your heart, like in your solar plexus, or in your guts, in your gastric plexus, and these are huge nerve complexes within the body. And it's kind of one of the peculiar aspects of modern thought is that everything has been withdrawn into the cranial cavity, and everything is explained in terms of the brain's activities. Well, the brain is obviously extremely important, extremely complicated, but the human body is incredibly complicated. And I agree with Theodore Roszak, who wrote several years ago in Where the Wasteland Ends, that this is can be characterized, this approach to studying human experience can be characterized as the psychic contraction, and everything is withdrawn into the space above the neck. And I think that that's a self-element in conventional thinking and contemporary thinking about consciousness, which is completely mistaken. And it's so interesting that scientists and psychologists often recognize and talk about the different experimenter effects and what are called demand characteristics in psychological experimentation, where unwittingly researchers can create the results that they're looking for, but they never seem to see this in themselves when they study consciousness. They never seem to see how their own state of consciousness, their own understanding of consciousness, distorts so much of their understanding of consciousness and their approach to consciousness. So there's that whole aspect. And then
I remember, just as an example, just to hold stop there for a moment, yeah, as you're sharing that, I remember, for example, in one of Charles Tart's books, he says, he talks about how he'll often ask his audience, like for them to become aware of themselves and to answer, like, I forget exactly how he words it, but it's to recognize that he asks them, isn't this the kind of consciousness you always have? Like, he gets them to reflect on their own, the nature of their own consciousness. But my point is, when he gets them to become aware of the nature of their own consciousness, the state he evokes by his question is slightly different than their state of consciousness was before he encouraged them to become aware of their own consciousness.
Yeah.
Like, this is a mistake the scientists make. They try to get a person, okay, we want you to become aware of your own consciousness and describe what it's like. But a person becoming aware of their own consciousness and describing it is in a slightly different state than they were in 5 minutes previously, where they weren't aware of their own consciousness at all. They were just thinking about what they got to do tomorrow, and they're embedded in the process of thinking and feeling. Okay, so when Charles Tartt's question, I want you to be aware of whether or not you're in a normal state of consciousness at the moment. That's how he asked him. And what's paradoxical is that his very question, in a way, alters or changes the nature of the person's self-awareness. And then what they report to him is not their normal consciousness state. It's kind of consciousness reflecting on itself. And we see this as a mistake also in the literature, the failure to recognize these subtle differences.
Yeah, it's what Uspensky describes in The Psychology of Man's Possible Evolution as the very funny trick that nature plays when you ask a person if they're conscious, and the question has made them conscious of themselves, and they'll say, of course they're conscious because they hear and understand you. And he said, here nature plays a very funny little trick, because in a sense, you're by drawing attention, by provoking the person to draw attention to their consciousness, they attend to their consciousness, and then they assume that that's their normal state. But as he says, the question itself has prompted a state which is actually different from the normal waking state. And that's a huge thing. I mean, that's the beginning of something immense, because to extrapolate beyond that, like the idea of studying yourself and trying to be aware of yourself, to remember yourself in Gurdjieff's terms, and to observe yourself systematically, what you're doing is you're accumulating these experiences, and they're very few, but you do accumulate these experiences where you are more conscious than you are normally, and these experiences have a very different quality to them. And if you have enough of these experiences, then you begin to acquire something different in yourself. Is very subtle. It's difficult to sort of describe it in normal language, but I think people repeatedly experience this. You begin to acquire the beginnings of something in yourself, which leads to a different kind of understanding, a different level of sensing of yourself and of your being and of your existence. And this leads to all sorts of different connections with other things which are beyond that which are given by our normal waking state, and which are apparent and evident in our normal waking state. Like what you were talking about too before, about the subtle bodies and these higher energies, is that within modern psychology, everything about consciousness is centered within the human being. Like we're just like these isolated, we're regarded as these isolated islands of consciousness in a universe which is governed by natural laws that describe mechanical processes and in which matter is dumb and non-sentient, in which everything just sort of collides in terms of like this Newtonian mechanical universe. But we know that that's not even an accurate description of the universe. And what really the mystical and esoteric perspective provides is by positing the existence of these higher being bodies, and by saying that there's a subtler levels of consciousness, we enter the extra dimensional world. Like we have a view, like what I think your model puts forth, Chris, is that we are multidimensional beings who exist in a multidimensional universe. And so many things that are anomalies and enigmas and mysteries within the conventional perspective of modern psychology and science, with the materialist perspective, become possible to explain, become explicable in terms of the mystical and esoteric teachings, because they have a way of connecting us not only with our higher levels of ourselves, but with the entire universe. Like this light that you described earlier, in a way, like this light, when Sri Chinmoy says that this light is within everyone, then this light of God unites everything and everyone. That's the highest kind of perspective on it. Now, what happens is that certain people have these experiences where they do experience themselves as this light, and they have these transcendent experiences where they experience the universe in a non-local manner, which is a direct experience of what is really the most baffling principle in quantum mechanics and in modern physics. Is like this idea that somehow, on some level, time and space as we normally understand them don't exist and can be transcended. Well, people actually describe these experiences repeatedly within the mystical literature, so there must be something to the mystical and esoteric conceptualizations of consciousness, which modern science is completely ignorant of and doesn't understand. I think that's that's what's really astounding. It's like you can apply this, you apply esoteric teachings on consciousness on all these different levels. They can very practically in your own life, that can make you a more grounded, satisfied, fulfilled, conscious person. But in the highest levels too, it can lead to people experiencing themselves as being one with the universe, and that's not just bad poetry about a metaphysical experience. It's like a profound statement about the nature of the self and the nature of the universe.
I was thinking also another thing that I think we offer a wholly different perspective on is concepts concerning the nature of the heart. And here is another item that, from a mystical perspective, modern scientists have completely erroneous ideas about the nature of the heart. Like, firstly, Jim and I emphasize that looking at a human being as a quantum system, meaning a being composed of matter and energy, we find that the electromagnetic volume of the heart is actually 10,000 times greater than the or 5,000 times?
Yeah.
5,000 times greater than the electromagnetic volume of the brain in the head. So from a physics perspective, if you looked at a human being without assuming that consciousness is only being produced in the mind, you would find that the center of a human being has to do with the heart and not the head. And the if you look on my website, or you, the Heart Math Institute in California has been exploring this same theme, and their work is very similar to my own in some respects, even though they don't explore the mystical dimensions of the heart so much. But they regard the life of the heart, even in a mundane way, as the kind of center of a person's psychology, rather than the mind in the head. And it's like what we've discussed before. In modern science, scientists assume that emotions are produced up in the limbic system, which is subcortical part of the brain. But we ask, like, how many people go home and tell your partner that you love them with all your head? Okay, because people don't think that emotions come. People know intuitively they associate emotions and love with the heart. And you find that in human language all the time. They say, I love you with all my heart. Or you love God with all your heart and soul. They connect the heart and the soul. I believe people have this intuitive knowledge that the heart is not simply soft muscular tissue with no awareness. I believe there's there can be an immediate awareness within the heart space. And in fact, I would say that our awareness of self is grounded in this, that it originates out of the heart. And as I've mentioned before, when I play the pointing game with people, getting them to point to different things in their environment, and then I ask them to point to themselves, people most frequently point to the area of the heart. They don't point to the head, where their consciousness is supposed to be. They point to the heart as being like the center of where they experience their own being existence. I think Gurdjieff's term in Beelzebub's Tales, where he talks about the totality of our being self-awareness, it's like when a person indicates the totality of their being self-awareness, they point to their heart rather than to their mind. And it's very infrequently that people point to their heads to indicate self, even though sometimes they indicate kind of halfway between their head and their heart, like their throat area, because it's like they're not sure. Their head is thinking about the question, and it interrupts their spontaneous. But you see, often when people just talk from themselves and they say, they point to their heart often. So I believe that there's this intuitive knowledge that people have about the heart, which really is more advanced than what they've arrived at in modern psychology, which modern psychologists don't think there's a psychology to the heart. Whereas in mystical teachings, the heart is the most important focus of consciousness, and it's as your heart is, so the man or woman is. in a way, it's the quality of the heart that's most important. And there can be evil tendencies in the heart and or a spiritual heart. There's said to be a spiritual heart center, which is kind of behind the heart. The spirit, there's actually said to ultimately be a divine source, divine spark. And then there's said to be the spiritual heart, and the spiritual self, and then the psychical heart, and then a physical heart. So the heart is not simply a physical organ, but it also has a psychical and spiritual nature to it. So when a person dies, the physical heart dies, but it doesn't mean that their spiritual heart center disappears. It still persists. It still exists. And this is what makes possible after-death experiences and experience in other dimensions. So it's not only do we radically question the modern concept of the nature of consciousness, but also the concepts of the nature of the heart. And it's like mystics through the ages have associated the I experience with the heart. And in yoga, self-realization is defined as the dissolution of the false mind into the lotus of the heart. So it's like we're trying to awaken the heart's consciousness and then to abide in it, like to maintain awareness in it. Because you can have experiences of higher consciousness, but usually they're just fleeting. They don't last. And what we try to do is to, through time, is try to maintain this heightened state of wakefulness.
Yeah, I think that you touched on something, Chris, and this is what you discuss in your book, The Heart Doctrine. This idea that throughout the mystical and esoteric literature is that this discussion of the heart, and repeatedly you kind of find these references to the spiritual spark at the heart of being, which is in many different traditions, and I guess it was probably about 20 years ago that you started to pursue this idea seriously about the heart doctrine versus the head doctrine in modern psychology, and you started sort of drawing on these different areas and producing material from these different teachings. I remember, I think it actually began with you being interested in the concept of the soul and really looking at the concept of the soul, which led to more and more to discussion of the heart. And over time, as you kept writing and rewriting this book, At different points, I think at a couple of times, I said to you, "You've actually got too much material. You know, there's too many.
Yeah.
There's too many quotes from too many traditions." But what's really interesting is that I've read. You know, I think I'm fairly reasonably well acquainted with material on mysticism, and many of the people who actually are sympathetic to the mystical and esoteric conceptions of consciousness, who are modern thinkers and theorists. I haven't read everybody, of course, and I haven't read all of the works of people like, say, Ken Wilber. But I notice that I've never seen this in anybody else's work. I don't think anybody recognizes it, and yet it's there. I had read different material from different teachings, and I didn't see this common element until you pointed it out, but it's there in every teaching. It's quite extraordinary once you see it. It's hidden in plain sight, and nobody's really given this idea serious consideration and tried to examine how it relates to the what the nature of consciousness is. And I would say this is one aspect of your model of consciousness, which I think is really is groundbreaking. And I think it's correct because it recurs in through so many different teachings. I mean, it makes sense to me in terms of a whole variety of different things that are far too complex to get into at this time. But the fact that it recurs in so many different teachings and is explained in essentially the same way in so many different teachings is, to me, really profound. It's really quite extraordinary that nobody's recognized this before, that the commonality of the teachings on the importance of the heart and of this idea that consciousness arises in the heart and that it's rooted into the subtle and higher dimensions of consciousness and being, and that these dimensions have correspondences in higher dimensions of the universe. It's such an extraordinary idea, but once you grasp it, it's completely logical and it's can be coherently elaborated, but it also makes it makes, as I as said earlier, it makes it possible to understand things that are inexplicable in terms of a materialist model of consciousness, and by adhering to the head doctrine, which I know is wrong. If nothing else, like, I know that the head doctrine is not right, and that people are really quite mistaken in approaching their study of consciousness under the belief or under the assumption that the head brain produces consciousness. It does not. Like, that's clearly wrong in my belief. Nobody will be able to convince me otherwise. So at the very least, it's so useful that way to get out of that mm-hmm. incorrect assumptive framework about consciousness.
Yeah, and your point is also, like, really valid. Like, what we find when we look at the mystical literature is, why are all these mystics in different traditions who make the effort to explore consciousness and try to approach nearer to God, because most of them are religiously oriented,
yeah.
like
yeah.
mystical teachings, it's those observers who all arrive at the same conclusion
yeah.
about the true nature of self is connected to the heart. And they discover this through their own studies of yoga, or in different traditions, it's different studies. So what we do have is independent observers who arrive at similar conclusions based on their own direct approach to consciousness, either through meditation or other spiritual practices. So that's really astounding in a way. And that's why it forms such a radical contrast. Like, the mystics elaborate the heart doctrine, and modern science for the past century has elaborated the head doctrine, which is the belief that the brain produces consciousness. And it's a profoundly important question, because it ties into the question of the existence of the human spirit and soul and how we know God. Because in all the mystical traditions, knowing God is most immediately related to the awakening of the heart. It's not that you know God with your mind in your head, even though if you become enlightened, you may have illumination of your mind and know God through the mind as well. But the most direct experience of self is associated with the heart. And I love the Jewish tradition in a way, because they have this where they say that the truth is under our noses all the time. And I think that's so profound, because it's like your heart is right under your nose. And I also like that in the native tradition, where they have the creation story, where the creator kind of creates the universe, and he's talking to the elders about where to hide the self. And one says, put it on the furthest stars, and another says, you know, put it on the top of the mountains, and they're where to hide the self. And then finally, it's determined that they'll put the self within their own heart. And so people will be looking for self all around themselves, outside of themselves, while the whole time the ultimate mystery is kind of right under your nose the whole time.
Yeah.
I think that's very beautiful. I love that native story.
Yeah, and there's a, Rumi, is it Rumi that has the poem where he talks about where he's looking for the self?
It's Rumi.
Yeah, and it's in his heart, and because he looks in the marketplace, and he looks in the temple, and he looks everywhere, but then he finds that it's within his own heart. I think one of the things that's really, well, a couple of comments. One, like this idea that all of these different traditions have independently come to this conclusion, friend, using different methodologies too. Like, I mean, different emphases in terms of their examination of the self and consciousness. But all of these traditions are involved with examining and studying consciousness. I mean, in terms of a science of consciousness and being, like, this is empirical study, and this is study which has been replicated in all these different laboratories throughout the ages. That would satisfy the criteria for a scientific discovery in terms of modern science. You know, I mean, just because it doesn't involve instrumentation and just because it doesn't involve external observation doesn't mean it's not scientific. I mean, I would argue very strongly.
Yeah, it can be replicated.
It can be replicated. That's
what your point is, eh? Like,
yeah, and
if someone else establishes the same conditions and undergoes the same psycho-spiritual processes, they come to a similar conclusion, which would make it replicable.
You see that throughout the esoteric traditions. If you do this, you know, there's an instrumental application. If you do this, this, and this, then that will happen, and that's really basically what science is. And I would argue very strongly that the problem with Western psychology in terms of trying to become a science is it tries to imitate the physical sciences, which is not really applicable to the study of consciousness. There are some things that can be observed externally, like you can watch animals and you can watch people and you can extrapolate laws of learning and behavior modification on an external basis, but that's not a complete psychology. And I would say that in terms of studying consciousness, that's the one big question where you really can't study things externally. You might be able to dissect the parts of the brain. You might be able to do studies in the brain, and you might be able to do studies in the heart. But ultimately, you have to study this within yourself, and that's what modern psychology has completely missed. But as I say, you have all of these different traditions independently working at the same kinds of questions and problems, coming up with the same answers. Now, you know, that's to me is overwhelmingly and compelling evidence that people have established something very important. There was something else I was going to say, and now I've completely forgotten what it was, like, related to this idea of studying yourself. But I'll come back to it later. But as I say, this is something that I just don't think is at all recognized. As I say, in terms of the heart doctor specifically, it hasn't been recognized at all. And I think that's, like, your work is really very unique in this sense, and I think very, very important and really needs to be explored and examined. Oh, I know what I was going to say. Just in terms of the heart. Now, one of the really interesting things is, I think, that sort of serendipitously corroborated much of what's in the heart doctrine is the whole development of resuscitation technology and cardiac arrest and the near-death experience. And I think we've gotten this from real life. We've gotten, it's not laboratory generated, it's like these are real life experiences, and we have all of these incredible experiences, which are all really independent experiments that couldn't ever be done in the laboratory. And then we have researchers who have studied this phenomena, which is really outside of the mainstream of modern scientific and psychological thinking. And some who have approached it very skeptically have all come up with this same kind of reaction, that this is something which is not explicable in terms of the materialist position, and that the whole set of protocols about what these experiences involve. And I think that's, to me, is one of the most compelling bodies of evidence which really substantiates and would have been predicted by anyone who was familiar with the heart doctrine. I think that this is entirely consistent. This evidence supports the idea that consciousness does arise from through the different levels of the heart, and then at death it withdraws into these different levels of the heart and goes into the subtle dimensions. And I think that's entirely consistent and would have predicted exactly what we have now learned through cardiac resuscitation technology has given us, like, this fantastic body of evidence.
Yeah. Boy, I saw an interesting YouTube the other week. Remember, when I was a university professor, I once used the book Recollections of Death by Michel Sabon, who was a doctor who was very skeptical of the near-death experiences.
Cardiologist, yeah.
Yeah, and he did an investigation of it, which turned him into a believer on it. But then he apparently, I saw on YouTube, there's a video where he was trying to address the question. Some people say, oh, it's just neurological, like random neurological processes in the brain that are kind of producing some of these illusions of being out of the body. And Sabon, in this YouTube, he deals with a case where this woman actually had all the blood drained from her body. And so it was absolutely no neurological activity And when she came back from after this operation, she reported out-of-body experiences. And in this case, her heart had stopped and all the blood had been withdrawn from her body, and yet she still came back. And
hello? Hello? Oh, I seem to have been lost here.
I remember all the stories my grandpa used to tell about a time in this sacred land. The buffalo did roam out on the open plain. The eagle soared high sky. There wasn't any shame, there wasn't any pain. Yes, he said, they were so very proud. They lived a simple life, Mother Nature did provide. There was no law, but there was no crime. And then the white man came. He brought his way of life. Nothing's been the same the day the white man came. Yes, they brought their whiskey and they brought their gun. They took away our land, they put us on the run. Locked us on this reservation, changed our ways of life. Promises were made, they were only lies. And then the white man came. He brought his way of life. Nothing's been the same the day the white man came. Some days what he said, the nations they will rise. All the chiefs from long ago, they will be by your side. Into the battleground, a warrior you will ride. Armed with years of wisdom, many years of pride. The day the white man came, he brought his way alive. Nothing's been the same the day the white man came. Thank you.
Thank you. That was called Sacred Land. And it's a sad song. It's like I feel that we as citizens of this earth have so defiled our nations and the arch criminal processes going on all around the world. It's like when one wakes up to the world situation, it's like waking up to in a madhouse. It's just incredible, the violence, the wars, the deceits of our government, the deceits of the media, the medical associations, the corruption of our politics. It's really, really quite tragic what has happened in terms of humankind.
It's kind of overwhelming, isn't it?
Sorry, Dee?
It's kind of overwhelming when you think about it. I mean, I know a lot of people who are very, very strong activists, and they're almost on burnout right now because they feel so overwhelmed. And then when you get into an election campaign like we're in right now, and you see that there is nothing coming from any of the parties, any of the major parties, that is capable in the least of solving the difficulties that we have. And primarily the reason for that is because you have such a divisive adversarial system of parliament, so that you've got a war going on between four parties. You know, there's a war going on instead of business being managed.
I'm going to just step back a bit and just, I'm afraid that I don't think I had introduced you. Well, I had said this is for our audience. Dee stepped in there. Dee's ready to go. She's an activist and she's off the blocks. This is Dee Nicholson, who I've known for several years now and is a major activist in Canada, especially related to health issues. And I get daily mailings from Dee, who's always sending me these informative things, and a kind of a critical person in the Canadian resistance movement and making an effort to wake people up. Yeah, it's really quite tragic, Dee, the way I see it. I mean, all four, it's just like in the United States. You got Republicans and Democrats, but they're both owned by the same cabal of international bankers.
It's sort of like taking a song. It's sort of like taking a song and rolling it on two different beats.
Yeah.
You know, like you can take a waltz and turn it into a rock shuffle. Okay? You can turn one of the old songs into a hip hop rhythm. You can just by messing around with the beats of a song, you can make it sound like a new song. And this is exactly what happens. And what we see is a vision of what, I don't know if you've seen the video Mouseland by Tommy Douglas. This is from a story he wrote back in 1944 and gave to the House in 1944. It's on YouTube. Just search for Mouseland with Kiefer Sutherland, who is Tommy Douglas's grandson.
Oh, really?
You will see exactly what we're going through right now. And that is, in his little speech, and this is accompanied by a great little cartoon, you've got a people of mice, namely Canadians, who have a government of cats. And everything that the government does is in favor of cats. And they're going, you know, why are we voting for these black cats all the time? So they tried voting for another color of cat.
Yeah.
And they got the same kind of crap out of the different colored cats as they got out of the first cat. Then they started voting for half black, half white cats. And that they called coalition.
Yeah.
Right? And so this whole video shows exactly what the dance is. We keep voting for people whose interest is not aligned with ours. And as long as we keep voting for people whose interests are not aligned with ours, we are going to get a government that is not aligned with what we want. And we, the Canadian people, have all of the power to fix everything. And it makes me damn mad to see Canadians going, well, you can't fight City Hall. Yes, you can. Yes, you can.
Yeah,
but you have
to
get your act together.
We need to be fighting City Hall, and we need larger numbers. And I went out to an anti-war demonstration in Ottawa last weekend. It was sad. It was like 100 people downtown in Ottawa. You know, and here Canada has just become involved in another criminal war. Like we
well,
see
you know,
now,
Ottawa's
NATO
a place
is
where the men are men and the sheep are scared.
What is that? Say again.
I said Ottawa's a place where the men are men and the sheep are scared.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, really. Yeah, it's so overwhelming because, see, now our major liberal and conservative parties, I mean, they've all maintained the public deception around 9/11, allowing the corporate media in Canada, the criminal corporate media, to deceive the Canadian population about what happened on 9/11. Because it's now known around the world it wasn't Muslims. So we became involved in a criminal war in Afghanistan.
And we're still there.
Sorry?
And we're still there. And
we're
with the
there.
Blessing, and this is what gets me, okay? I'm seeing these two other, and I apologize to people in Quebec, but the Bloc is never, and even Gilles Duceppe said during the debate, I will never be prime minister. So, I mean, he's in there trying to represent Quebec. Good for him. That's fine. However, there are only three possible candidates for prime minister, and one of them is a real slow starter, and that's Layton. So you've got these guys who essentially, over the past 20 years, you can track the record of all these different governments. And when have we ever seen any of these governments protect Canadian sovereignty? When have we ever seen that? They are all guilty of signing away our sovereignty. And I'm not going to let Jack Layton off the hook because he's the only, he's the head of the only party which has taken a stand on sovereignty to a degree. And yet, I turn around and I see that Bill C-36, the Consumer Product Safety Act, passed the House with a unanimous vote, including the NDP, who were seated on that day. And then, after C-36 passed, they came out with talking points. You know those annoying, stupid letters that you get back when you send an email? Mm-hmm. And they all sound like, they come from 100 different MPs, but they all sound exactly the same and have the same things to say. And the talking points that Jack Layton had in his post-C-36 letter included the words that it's absolutely wonderful that we are now on a level playing field with our trading partners. Now, excuse me all to hell, you cannot have it both ways. If you have a level playing field with your trading partners, by contract, you don't have sovereignty. So where's this fight for sovereignty, Jack?
Yeah.
And Jack is my member of parliament.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you just see, I've seen a YouTube video of someone approaching Jack Layton asking him about 9/11 because the NDP is supposed to be the one party that would end the war. And someone asks Jack Layton about it and he kind of poo-poos it and says, oh, it's only a matter of historic interest. Excuse me, we've just had over 100 Canadian soldiers murdered in a criminal war based on lies which the government enables.
Uh-huh.
I mean, in my
And it's liable, Christopher, to get worse with the Libya situation.
Yeah.
And that one is so blatant. That, I mean, come on. They seem to think it's like we're going back to the Nazi era.
Yeah.
In the Third Reich.
Yeah, we are.
Because you're looking at the theory of the bigger the lie, the easier it is to sell. Now, here you've got a guy, Muammar Gaddafi, who holds no political office in Libya, none whatsoever. He's simply a colonel of the military. Okay, but his people have followed him happily for 40 years because they live in a society that has has had, under his tutelage, greatly improved their standard of living. There's very little poverty. It's usually self-induced poverty because over there, every Libyan is guaranteed an income of what equates to $15,000 per year. And every couple that gets married gets $50,000 to start their life with. Every child gets a full education for free, including university, including offshore university for free. Okay,
and
on top of that,
good health care also, Dee, they've established in Libya, yeah.
Yes, absolutely. And then, on top of that, you know, Libya is on the south shore of the Mediterranean, and it's desert, right? So what does Gaddafi do? He looks at options for creating an agricultural industry to feed Libyans, okay? How
yeah.
can he do that? Well, he can either desalinate ocean water from the Mediterranean, or he can import water, both of which are at great, great cost. And then he thought, let's tap what's underneath Libya. There's got to be water down there. And sure enough, there used to be a full aquifer running through North Africa, including Libya. That aquifer has dried up to the point where it no longer flows. So it's trapped in reserves of water underneath the deserts. It's called fossil water. And so, I mean, it's only fossil water because it's trapped in the rocks.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, just like a fossil would be.
Yeah.
So what
yeah, under
did he
the
do?
Sahara, he, under the deserts.
Yeah, and he tapped into that and irrigated thousands and thousands of acres of previous desert and turned them into green zones that are capable of feeding the nation.
Yeah.
These are the things that Gaddafi stands accused of. And really, what's behind this is because for 25 years, Gaddafi has refused to become part of the international banking cartel.
Mm-hmm.
His banks charge no interest. They charge fees. They're under Islamic rules.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you see, in the meantime, now this rebel force, we don't even know who this rebel force is, except that we are shown persistent images of the same white pickup truck with the same yahoos in the back firing guns in the air. And then you find out that, son of a gun, haven't they started a new central bank in Libya called the Central Bank of Benghazi, which in a matter of weeks managed to get chartering and acceptance and ratification all the way up to the IMF.
Yeah, isn't that amazing?
Now, how in the flying hell did they do that when they aren't even a government? And further to that, they formed a nationalized oil company. How the hell did they do that when the government has not fallen? You see, we are being fed like mushrooms, kept in the dark and fed shit.
That's good.
This is exactly,
yeah, exactly.
what's going on. Canadian
exactly.
people are being fed like mushrooms. And the thing is, the information, the truth is out there. I mean, if you want to go back to the X-Files, it's not that hard to find out the truth. All you've got to do is ask. It is right under your nose. All you've got to do is use your Google engine or whatever, or Scroogle or whatever search engine you want. You will find evidence of the lies.
Yeah.
You will find it everywhere. And what has really got me ranting today is the fact that I'm getting so many phone calls and emails from people saying, well, geez, you know, it looks like there's nothing we can do. It's overwhelming. They're everywhere. It's everywhere. And my response to that is very simple. We are everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
We are
everywhere.
There's
just everywhere. Not enough of us. You know,
lots of us. We outnumber them literally billions to one.
Yeah, except the masses are so asleep. It's like television has become this amazing mechanism of mass propaganda and perpetrates all the lies. Like, people are completely deceived. Like, we know Canadians, they already don't, they want to end the war. And if Canadians really knew that their government had lied to them about this war and gone along with it, and then lied to them about the war in Libya, I mean, Canadians would be outraged. But there's just the masses of people don't realize it. It's like we've got a government that's become so criminal and deviant over decades that you know, it's very hard to break through that conditioning. It's so heavy.
Let me just point the people listening to this website, okay? Because if you want, in a nutshell, I mean, we're talking a bird's eye view of what this man and his cohorts have done over his last 5 years or so in office. This is the website to go to because it has everything categorized. You just keep clicking show me more. Show me more, okay? And every time you click, you get another thing that he did. And every time you open another page, it's like, holy crap, he did that.
Yeah.
And a lot of this stuff, you and I never heard of, okay? We never heard about this. Why didn't we hear about it? Well, we'll get to media in a minute. But, I mean, this website, people, you got to check this out. It's called www.shitharperdid.ca. Okay? This is the website.
Yeah.
www.shitharperdid.ca. And I'll tell you, if you are a candidate that is not a conservative, you know, just put them on your iPod, man, because you can just ream these off as you campaign at the doors. Just ream them off.
Yeah.
What he has done to disempower First Nations people, to disempower women, to stifle the Christian religion, to do all kinds of things that we as Canadians have always stood for. This man is single-handedly destroying. And you'll notice from the candidates' rolls, there's a lot of conservatives aren't running this time. There's conservative candidates. It's like the rats are leaving the ship.
I hope so.
Well,
I hope
I'm
so. I mean, in
so
Canada,
too.
I mean, I guess the strongest movement, I hope at the moment, is anyone but Harper. Like, I mean, they're all terrible, I want to ask you about the leader of the Liberals, because he, to me, is just another very suspicious character, and I want to ask about him. But I mean, would you say a lot of Canadians are feeling anyone but Harper?
I would say a lot of Canadians are. I don't put a lot of faith in the polls. Mm-hmm. I don't think Canadians are that stupid. I think they're incensed over the G20. I think they're incensed over the contempt of Parliament charge that Harper has basically just said, oh, well, that was nothing. Let's just move on.
Yeah.
You know, nothing.
Where he lied to the, well, he wouldn't reveal what was it he was in contempt for. He wouldn't reveal where the money went.
He wouldn't reveal the contracting on the F-35 stealth fighters.
Oh, yeah.
He wouldn't reveal them. Now, that's a very bad plane, by the way. It's
yeah,
a single engine, which means if that engine goes, our pilot's ejecting. And there goes a $1 billion plane that has one engine. Okay.
Yeah.
Furthermore, it doesn't have the agility. It doesn't have the firepower. There are several planes out there that are vastly superior and a great deal cheaper. And the Harper government ignored those. I'm wondering who the hell they know at the company that's building these F-35s, because, man, this is a really bad deal. Furthermore, as our friend Jeremy Arney, who's fast becoming one of Canada's top freedom bloggers, we love Jeremy to bits, he came out with a blog last week outlining everything that was wrong with the F-35s and what was wrong with the deal. And this is the same deal, bear in mind, that Harper would not reveal the details of. In fact, these planes are not even approved to be built just yet. There are planes we could have right now for less than half the cost that would outfly the F-35s in a hot second. In fact, what Jeremy said was, he was on my show, realhealthonthatchannel.com, Mondays at 8 p.m. Eastern, in case you're listening. He said that if he were flying an F-35 and he saw one of the new Russian fighters coming at him, he would get his butt out of there as quick as he could and hope the Russian didn't see him.
Yeah.
Because these planes are good for is shooting on civilians. That's all it's good for. Now, why are we buying jet fighters at $1 billion apiece? In fact, it's what, $29.5 billion or something for 35 planes? Why are we spending that, nearly $1 billion a plane, to bomb civilians?
And I think we kind of know. It's criminal racketeering, in my view, between Harper and his buddies who are in the war industries, the same people who are mass murdering people all around the world.
Precisely.
And it's the same people. It's just like, how can Harper spend $300 million to give Gardasil vaccinations to young girls in eastern Canada? He should serve life for that, in my opinion.
And how can they give natural product licenses to things like Crest toothpaste full of fluoride, PEG-12, which is polyethylene glycol, aspartame, saccharin? Okay.
I know. See, these
how
people,
can they do that?
Yeah, nope. Well, because they serve these psychopaths who
exactly.
are bringing in their new world order system, which is
exactly.
A
and let me tell you, there is a new attack going on right now, and this attack is against the natural health industry, and it is headed by none other than Health Canada, which
yeah.
is mandated to protect our access to natural health products. Ha ha.
Yeah.
We wish it were so, and I hope the buggers are listening, because if anyone is traitorous to this nation, it is those fools at Health Canada who foist false health care on us in the name of what is licensed and approved and basically oversee our death.
Yeah. I mean, the traitorous and treasonous activities, I mean, it's all through the government. It's all the RCMP. The RCMP don't serve the Canadian people. The 9/11 was the largest mass murder of Canadians in this century, and the RCMP have colluded to deceive the Canadian public about who did it. Because now millions of people...
And, of course, they're colluding with each other in order to protect themselves when the axe falls, as they did in the Jakansky case, as they have done in subsequent cases, as they have done with the G20 fiasco, as they keep on doing. We've had trouble at the top of the RCMP for a long time, ever since, like, even before Zaccardelli. And now we've got trouble with the new guy who just quit. You know, I mean, we've got all kinds of massive... problems with our policing in this country, and there's no question of that. Our police are not the same kind of cops that you and I grew up with.
No.
They're not the guy who's walking along on the beat swinging his billy club, whistling, and saying hello to everybody by first name. They're no longer like that. These guys, a lot of them, and I'm sorry to say it, because I'm sorry to see the honor go out of our police force. It used to be, if you saw a boy in blue, it was... There goes an honorable man. Okay? You can't say that anymore.
No, you can't.
You know, we've got senators under criminal charges right now, conservative senators, haha.
Yeah, do it.
You know, and two MPs.
Yeah.
So we've got Harper cohorts going down with criminal charges left, right, center, and sideways. We've got the RCMP a dubious starter. And bear in mind that the Dudley Do-Right cartoons came out because the... RCMP logo always had in it, maintien le droit, maintain the right.
Oh.
Okay? And they used to live up to that. And we used to be very proud of our RCMP.
Yeah.
Because
yeah,
they
grew
were
up with
the
that.
Righteous.
I always felt a certain pride in the RCMP.
Exactly. I mean, the musical Ride is a very stirring performance, but it used to have a lot more behind it than just a bunch of well-trained black horses and guys in red suits. And it's not the spectacle it used to be, because it doesn't stand for what it used to stand for.
No.
And this is anybody who is over 50 in this country knows exactly what I'm talking about. They know exactly what I'm talking about. We used to have pride in these things, and we no longer can. And who is at fault here? It's not just Harper.
No, it's not just Harper. No, he's just a puppet. I mean, But I do.
He's a symptom, Christopher. He's a symptom of our illness, is what he is. He's a symptom of our illness. And until Canadians take the responsibility that is theirs and get off their hindquarters in front of their large screen TVs watching the Stanley Cup playoffs or whatever idol of the week they're voting for.
The
rest of us who know. It's like, holy smokes, we're on a ship that's headed over a waterfall, and we're sitting in the back going, no, 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 and the rest
and no
of
one wants to hear
TV.
From us. Our family say, we don't want to hear about that. You know, they can't face it. They can't grasp it.
No.
That's what I find. Yeah, I really want to get... I mean, I'm praying we get rid of Harper. I mean, I'm ashamed to be Canadian. I feel the shame now.
I know.
He so loves Israel. He so goes out, and no matter what war crimes Israel does, Harper gives them our unconditional support. I mean, my feeling is that Canada is run by the Jewish mafia. That's where I think Canada is.
Exactly.
That's the problem.
And look what he did to Kairos funding. Okay, now Kairos, I think, has an unfortunate name. And the reason it has an unfortunate name is because it sounds entirely too foreign. But what Kairos is a committee founded by all of the major Christian religions in Canada to support the Palestinian people with food and aid. And that son of a bitch cut those people's aid, right, through Bev Oda, who inserted the word not and then denied ever seeing the document, the lying so-and-so, right?
Yeah.
And she got convicted of contempt of parliament. And you know the only people who could have punished Harper and Oda for what they did was parliament. Now, why, when Michael Ignatieff, speaking of which, brought that motion of non-confidence forward on the grounds of contempt of parliament, why did he not also bring a motion for punishment? He had the power.
Well, because I think there's an answer to that.
You're busted, and maybe it's time for you to move on, but hell, I'm not going to upset this apple cart. This is too good.
And Ignatius must have things like that. Can you tell us, he's such an odd character. He's not really Canadian, I don't think. He doesn't feel it. He's so deceptive. I mean, he's lived outside of Canada for 25 years. I've always seen him as a New World Order puppet who they're trying to put into power now. Do you see it that way?
Well, 25 years, but where in those 25 years?
Was it France?
Would you believe Harvard?
Where?
Harvard. Harvard University. He was teaching at, and you know, there's been jokes made about maybe if he doesn't win in the election, is he going to ever go back to Harvard and teach? Okay, so this guy's sitting in Illuminati Central, Harvard University, for God's sake, Harvard and Yale, the center of skull and bones, the center of masonry, the center of all that kind of stuff. He's in the middle of that for 25 years. Then he gets parachuted into Etobicoke North Riding over the objections, the strenuous objections of the Riding Association out there. When Paul Martin brought him in as a parachute, he did two of them that year. Okay, one of them was Ruby Dalla, and the other one was Michael Ignatieff. Now, interestingly enough, they both got elected, even though the people who live in those ridings were highly skeptical.
Yeah.
Highly skeptical of, you know, what's going on here, that Harper did this, or that Martin did this. But they both got in, and they both progressed, right?
Yeah.
Both of them. So, I mean, and Ruby Dalla even became a minister, or what, I can't remember. But, you know, this is how the game is played. Then we have Julian Fantino, our erstwhile minister for seniors. Now, he, as a senior citizen, doesn't have to worry about a darn thing because he has literally millions upon millions upon millions of dollars stashed in bank accounts all over the world, largely in the Bahamas, run out of, I believe it's Palermo, Italy, and he has accounts with U.S. dollars, with pounds sterling, with euros, and other currencies, literally all over the world. A lot of them are in the Bahamas. He has a number of accounts in the Bahamas. Now, these millions did not come from being a police chief. I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah.
They did not come. He never got a salary that could have made him that kind of money.
Yeah.
He's also a member of a corporation called Superstars Inc. And this corporation, which if you Google it, you just might find out some very interesting members in that corporation. And a lot of very, very, very famous names on both sides of political fences. And a lot of people from the Royal Bank of Canada. And all of these people, this is a corporation registered down in the Bahamas, and it includes all these major Canadians. And they're all making mega bucks. and they all have private accounts. And the skullduggery that goes on beneath the surface, I mean, we're stunned enough at what's surfaced, okay?
Yeah.
If we as Canadians had any idea of the depth of the corruption here, the depth of it is stunning. I mean, we are seeing our nation being literally stripped of its sovereignty, which the New World Order types all believe is a pesky nuisance because it creates things like trade barriers and internet and national laws that other people have to comply with. So in order to get rid of those pesky little regulations, they want sovereignty to go away for the sake of trade. Now, that might all be well and fine because, you see, it's not about who's governing. It's about whether they're benign or not. If it's a good global government, I don't think anybody would object to it.
Yeah.
It's not about a good global government.
No.
It's not. This is about multinational corporate control. This is about global fascism. This is not about a benign leadership that is destined to make a paradise of this earth, which it could very easily be if we simply only followed one rule. All of us, one law only, gets us everything we need. And that is if every single one of us, and that includes our politicians, our leaders, our royalty, our wealthy people, if it all came down to one rule, it is do no harm to anyone, including yourself.
Yeah, okay, I was thinking do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Because I don't like the government allowing us to be poisoned with chemtrails and poisoning our water and poisoning our food.
Here's the interesting thing, Christopher. That golden rule that you just quoted, that's how you do no harm.
Yeah.
Okay? It makes of the Ten Commandments, it makes of the Ten Commandments a guidebook to living by doing no harm. And interestingly enough, and this I think people need to recognize, because I see them as very much lost in their lives, and they don't know, because they don't think with forethought, what harm they do when they buy this or that, when they do this or that, when they participate in this or that, or when they support this or that. They don't understand. Now let's take it just to the Talmud, which is an interesting tome of Jewish law.
Yeah.
It has the most succinct statement of the golden rule that I think exists in any religion, and bear in mind, the golden rule is in all of them. It's in every single one, bar none. It is in every single one. And what the Talmud says is, do not unto your brother that which you would not wish your brother to do unto you. This, in fact, is the only law. All else is but commentary. And it's true.
Wow. Well, that's interesting to hear that from the Talmud, because the Talmud also largely distinguishes between Jews and Goyim. Talmud allows, like, says that it's okay for a Jew to swindle a Goyim out of their money.
It's not about the messenger, is it? It's about the message. If the message is true and good, it's true and good no matter which mouth it comes out of.
Okay.
All right, because
I'm not sure what
you're saying. Do not unto your brother what your brother would, what you would not have your brother do unto you. That is a truism. We all hold that to be true, and it doesn't matter that it comes out of a book like that.
Well, Talmud is also full of other material that says Goyim aren't brothers to Jews.
Oh, sure.
Goyim are regarded as.
And we can go into the Bible. And we can go into Leviticus, and we can haul out that old argument that was up on a radio when it, what was that name, the woman that used to, Dr. Laura, okay, Schlesinger, Dr. Laura Schlesinger. She was a real right-winger, that one, and she came out very, very strongly against homosexuality, okay, was real fascinating. Somebody wrote back metaphor, but said, you know, it says that I may keep slaves. If I can keep slaves, can I keep Canadians? Yeah, I mean, you know, it's just like the whole thing was hilarious, ripping it all apart. So Bible's full of that stuff, too.
Yeah.
The trick is, do we discern what's right? If we discern what is right, we will come out of that with the gift that it is meant to give us. Okay? If we can discern what is right. And that's all we need to do to start on the road to healing, is to start doing what is right. Our parliamentarians need to do what is right for us. We need to do what is right for us. We need to participate if we expect others to do what is right. And we need to stop this blame game. I mean, if you ever watch Question Period in Parliament, it's a literal joke and a half.
I find it disgusting, too. It so sickens me. It's like we have such problems in this nation, and they don't address any of the real issues. No.
In fact, when one side stands up, and like the opposition stands up and asks a question and starts accusing the government of doing this or that, the government doesn't answer the question. The government, and they do this at all levels, okay? Don't think this is unique to Parliament. It isn't. It's the same in the provincial house and in city councils everywhere. What they do is they stand up and they say, yeah, but when you were in power, this is what you did.
They don't
answer the question. They turn it back and said, but yeah, your government screwed up this way. Well, if that's the case, the observer, you look at these guys and you go, okay, so you're both screw-ups. What's next?
Yeah.
What's next? Well, when do the brains in the House sit down together and say, you know what, we could solve this if we all did this? And to hell with party policy. How about what's right? How about doing what's right for Canadians?
Well, it's like there's a complete breakdown of moral integrity in Canadian politics, just as there is in the States. I mean, it's tragic what's been done to the American people through the military-industrial complex.
They've
destroyed the middle class, destroying America as a country, poisoning the people of America. They want Americans to be third-class, third-country status. And this has been done intentionally over 60 years. Have you ever heard of the Davignon Report from the Club of Rome?
Mm-hmm.
That was 50 years ago, and they set the intention that they wanted to destroy the middle class in America and bring down America.
They had to do that because if they wanted to depopulate, they had to weaken the center. They had to weaken the center, and they've done that. And now you've got a society that is split between the wealthy and the serfs. And we've gone back. I mean, I've heard people call it techno-feudalism, okay? I would say it's basically industrial feudalism is what it is, because the only thing that stopped feudalism was the Industrial Revolution. And now they've found a way to inject feudalism back into the way things are run.
Yeah, even with our technological advances, they want to bring back a new feudalism.
And now they've got it, so the technological advances actually assist them, because now they've got robotics. They can fire more of us.
Yeah.
You know? So fewer animals can supply more milk. They're treating the Earth right now, in terms of the human population, is being run like a CAFO. You know what CAFO is?
No, I don't.
Concentrated animal feeding operation.
Oh, yeah.
This is where the cows and the pigs and the chickens never see the light of day. They are raised industrially indoors. They don't know what it's about to be outside. They don't know what grass is. They get fed whatever crap the industry decides is cheapest and will do the job of fattening them up or making them produce more milk than they should. And they breed them, and they put them in the line, and that's it. And this is how they are treating human beings. We have lost more than 50,000 family farms in this country since NAFTA.
Yeah.
People don't know that.
50,000, farms.
Yeah. And now we've got NAFTA is not our biggest threat. Bigger threat than NAFTA is the fact that these trade agreements that we're signing now, including CETA, are going to enable Monsanto to come in and basically take over, because essentially you cannot protect your crop from GMO pollination.
Wow.
And they want to give the ability to raise GMO alfalfa in this country. Now, alfalfa is a perennial plant that grows everywhere, and it is not one of those seeds that does it, that's Terminator. It reproduces itself.
Oh, yeah.
So once this crap gets, you know,
no turning back.
None whatsoever. And it's also transmitted by bees. It will wipe out the bee population with genetically modified pollen.
Yeah. See, you just see, like, the Monsantos could not possibly have done what they've done in Canada without the complete corruption of the police. They allowed Monsanto's criminal activity against the farmers.
I mean, how
Monsantos can sue someone when they infest someone else's field with their crops? They should be paying damages. They're the ones who should be paying damages. It just shows you the extent of the corruption of the RCMP and the judiciary.
And the government, because the government is approving legislation that indemnifies Monsanto and, in fact, gives them the right to sue. And this is being challenged now, finally. And I'm going, where were you 5 years ago, you people?
We were all asleep at the wheel. I mean, we needed to have been...
Well, here's the thing, Christopher. They wait until the heel of government stomps on their toes before they open their mouths.
Yeah.
They sit back and they say, well, they're not... This is Pastor Niemöller all over again.
Yeah.
You know, I wasn't Jewish. They were coming for Jews. I wasn't Jewish, so I didn't speak up. They weren't coming for me.
Yeah.
Right?
And then you weren't a trade organizer. Exactly.
This is exactly what's going on because, again, this has only happened, and, you know, I have to keep telling people because they don't get it. They really don't get it. This could not have happened unless we all turned a blind eye. When we turned a blind eye, when we trusted people because of fast words and big wallets, okay, when we got greedy ourselves and followed all the promises of these guys who said they would enrich our lives, when we already had enriched lives, we live in a country of abundance. We had rich lives. We followed them, and we agreed with them, and we let them do what they have done, and to this day, we continue to let them do it. So I'm not willing to say that these guys are all criminal and these guys are all evil and we've got to get rid of these guys. No, we've got to get first rid of the apathy that has and the fear and the reticence of Canadians and people around the world to say, wait a minute, we count. And we're going to be counted. And what we are counting does not include your tactics. We do not include your corruption. We do not want your corruption. And then you set it up so that every policy that you've got is about not doing any harm to anybody. And, of course, if you don't sow it, you can't reap it, right?
Yeah.
Now, I'm afraid for Canada's karma, thanks to Harper. I'm very much afraid for Canada's karma. He's turned us from a peacekeeping nation, and that status we were terribly proud of.
Yeah.
Terribly proud of. And he's taken that from us and made us warmongers.
Yeah. And involved us in criminal wars. I mean, the Mideast wars are all criminal wars.
Of course they are.
Yeah.
I mean, you can see that. Yeah. Anytime you see the international banking community swooping into Libya and rushing... I can't believe that they would do this on this timing because it just exposed everything. They set up a national central bank, the Central Bank of Benghazi, it's called. Look it up, folks. The Central Bank of Benghazi. They set this up, but there's no nation to set it up as a central bank in.
Yeah.
How did they do this? Unless it was criminal. How did they do it?
Yeah, and it was all prescripted because they helped fund the rebels in the first place. I mean, they create the problem, they fund the opposition, and then they pretend they're coming in on a humanitarian basis.
Christopher, let's very quickly look at some of those rebels. The rebels that we are supposedly protecting and assisting over in Libya right now also include the LIFG. The LIFG is an acronym that stands for the Libya Islamic Fighting Group.
Yeah.
okay, the Libya Islamic Fighting Group, LIFG, which has close ties with, take a rough guess, just off the top of your head.
Not Israel.
No, but Al-Qaeda.
Otherwise known
as Al-Qaeda.
Al-Qaeda, yeah.
Yeah. Now, this is interesting because, you know, just a few miles away, a little bit farther east, what are they doing? They're fighting Al-Qaeda. Now, a few kilometers west, they're aiding Al-Qaeda. Now, where does this make any sense? And how does Al-Qaeda get to help set up a central bank and a national oil field? How does this happen? And then, a couple of weeks ago, we hear that Obama has authorized CIA activity on the ground in Libya, and that means CIA assassination squads. That's what that means.
Yeah, he's authorized murders anywhere in the world.
Of anyone, even including a citizen of another country, if they believe, and this is without a trial, without an examination of fact, without you being able to defend yourself, if they think you are a threat to the American government in any way, or even disagree and have a following
anyone who speaks the truth.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, the Patriot, people in the Patriot movement, the Truth movement, all these pose a threat to the government because we've woken up to realizing the government is a criminal cabal who don't represent the people. Like, we don't live in democracies anymore. We live in psychopathocracies, I call them. We're run by a group of psychopaths.
Yeah, they are, and they are. I mean, it is a corporation.
Yeah,
and you know that corporations, they meet every criterion for psychopath.
Yeah.
They meet all of them because there's no emotion there. Of course, the U.S. Supreme Court has declared them to be persons, so maybe they do have personalities, in which case they ought to be on Prozac.
But, yeah, really.
But, you know, I mean, the bottom line here, Christopher, is that we all need to stand up and be counted. If we stand up and be counted, then we have a democracy. Democracy is a failed system, and the reason it's a failed system is because it depends on one factor that has never, ever been included. It sounds good, but the only thing is you can't have people voting out of ignorance. You have to have people being informed with the truth, and because all the way back to the art of war, you've got
the
control of information is the key to victory.
Oh, yeah.
So what do they do? They prevent us from having the information, and then they let us vote. Isn't that white of them?
Yeah, and not only that, but like it's obvious now, the corporate media is completely criminal. They hide all the criminal acts of the government from the public. They even help stage events.
David Rockefeller thanked the press club for its 40 years of compliance, without which they couldn't have done what they did. It came out of, I mean, that quote is well known.
Yeah, very, exactly. You see, even in Canada, Peter Mansbridge, the head of the CBC, you know where he attended this year or last year? The Bilderberg Group.
Yeah.
And Harper's attended the Bilderberg Group 3 times.
Which means he's being groomed. You see, this is the thing. Back in 2003, the first election against Martin, and Martin came in with the minority. I think that was 2003, and then we had another election in 2004. But in 2003, when Harper lost, I told people, and I was doing public relations for a conservative candidate who was running against Joe Volpe. Now, I said to the entire campaign team, I said, Harper's not going to win this time. But I said, he's going to win next time. And the candidate said to me, how do you know that, Dee? And I said, it's very simple. He just went to the 2003 Bilderberg Conference at Versailles.
Really? Wow.
And he said, well, what's that got to do with anything?
And I said, he was on the eBay.
You don't get to be prime minister unless you're invited to that party.
Yeah.
And I said, you'll notice that he was invited this year, okay? That means he's going to be prime minister and very soon, but it won't be this time. It was too soon. Sure enough.
Wow, he's invited this year again.
Oh, of course he is.
Yeah.
Of course he is. He probably has the ability to add on invitees at his own discretion.
Yeah. Dee, I noticed we're coming. We only have a few minutes left. What would you recommend to Canadians in this election? Like, my one inclination I have, I don't want to vote for anyone because I consider all of them are controlled by the same mafia, which is running our country. But then I also think we got to vote like anything but Harper movement. I kind of agree with that.
Yeah, well, you see, here's the deal. The problem that we've got is that the vast majority of Canadians who can vote will vote. And they'll go out in their numbers and they will probably, and I'm hoping that they probably will vote anything but Harper, because I'll tell you, some of the best governments, is, you know, in terms of, I mean, I guess you're comparing grades of feces here, but the thing is that our best governments have been coalitions between Liberals and NDP.
Yes. Yeah.
And I'm hoping for that. I really am, because those are very, very people-oriented governments, and that could get us a breather. It won't get us a reprieve completely, okay?
Yeah.
But it will get us a breather, because there's a grace period. We generally have a grace period after an election where if there's a switch in parties, if there's a switch in government, it gives the new guy a chance, and things kind of float along for a little while. So I'm hoping that we make a change, that Canadians are not snowed. I'm hoping that they, for once, will recognize that they have a dictator in power who literally has taken the National Portrait Gallery and put all pictures of himself. Okay?
Yeah,
all pictures of himself. This is the guy who says, I make the rules. Him we got to get rid of. So I agree with anybody but Harper, but here's the thing. Do not pick randomly. If the goal is to get rid of Harper, then go back into last year's electoral or last election's results. Okay? They're online at Elections Canada. And I believe there's also a site out there that does election results. Canada, and if you just Googled Election Results Canada, you might find that site as well. But what it'll do is it'll show you who came second last time.
Oh, yeah.
It'll show you the leaning of your riding.
Yeah. And
okay,
then, I saw that site that has that. It lists all the electoral districts across Canada and who they recommend to vote for as an anti-Harper movement. Yeah.
Well, it says who's holding the seat now, right? And who would be the best one to vote for. It also, by color, shows you where the incumbents are. And bearing in mind, Harper doesn't have a majority. He has a minority. So there's a lot of ridings that are fairly secure already against Harper. The ones that we need to get are the ones that are for Harper. And in those particular ridings where you've got sitting conservatives, you've got to go to whatever came second in the last race.
Yeah,
the odds
are good
if it's a conservative riding. It's probably the Liberals.
Yeah, I'll have to bite my tongue when I go out and vote Liberal.
I
hate them. Ignatius is so horrible.
I don't quite have that problem, because in my riding, I'm almost guaranteed that there will be no conservative that is going to win here. In fact, they aren't even wasting a good candidate here. Excuse me, because my riding is Jack Layton's.
Oh, yeah. Dear.
I think he's going to hold on to
down
it, you know?
A lot by the NDP. I always grew up kind of supportive of the NDP, and it was
hard for me to believe that they were
part of the same thing, and to see that is it's tragic what's been done to Canada.
Politics. It was always people politics and union politics, and it affected the little guy, the blue-collar worker. And we've had some really, really wonderful members of Parliament that have been, instrumental in some really good stuff happening in this country. And, you know, it's not all doom and gloom. There's been some really good things happen. And I think that essentially what people need to do is they need to, first of all, examine their conscience. Do they really want this country run by a dictator? Because if they do, they've got one in Harper. They really do have one in Harper.
We're just down to the last moments. Dee, you have a very interesting online news hour. It's called thatchannel.ca.
No, it's The Real Health Show. It airs at 8 p.m. Eastern on thatchannel.com.
Oh, dot com. Okay.
Yeah, thatchannel.com, 8 p.m. Monday. The show is called Real Health. This week, we're featuring Terry Wilson from Canadian Awareness Network, canadianawareness.org. You might find some very interesting stuff at that site. And Terry will be on talking about how Health Canada is declaring unnatural stuff natural.
Yeah, great. Thanks for being with us, Dee.
Thanks for having me, Christopher.
And thanks for your efforts. Thanks for your efforts. We just got to keep going.
Yeah, well, the flames lick at the feet every once in a while, but we try to keep going.
Yeah. Okay,
anyways,
thanks, Dee.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Okay, and this is Christopher. We'll just wind down our show. Thank you, Seth and Don and Doug at BBS Radio, and we'll be back in 2 weeks. And try to remember yourself. If you're Canadian, let's get out there and talk to people about what's happening in our country. Confront some of our local politicians. I'm going out tonight hoping that I'm going to run into this conservative airbag we have in our riding. Confront him publicly with some of the crimes. These are criminal parties taking over our country. It's really quite tragic. Okay, thank you all, and let's also patriotic Americans. You need to take back your country like we in Canada need to take back ours. And this needs to be a people's movement around the world to take back our democracies. Okay, they've been stolen from us. We have to have the courage to face this crisis in the life of humanity. Thank you all. Goodbye.